Just to start out with, if anybody ever has any questions, feel free to just type it in, and I'll take a look at it, and that'll allow me to respond to you in a timely manner, but without interrupting entirely my train of thought. But please feel free to jump in at any time. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about what my plan is for the next, I don't know if we call it semester, maybe 2 months worth. And I think it's going to be very interesting what we try to do here. Now, I've been doing, keeping up a regimen for a while of trying to do one book review a week on my blog, and it's actually an extremely tough regimen to do. If you think about it, you have to read a book every week and write about it. But what I can cover in one blog post, 700 words, I actually have no idea how many words, but if not too many words, is not much. It's very superficial. So what I'm hoping to do this semester is to go more in depth and see some of the trends. And when you read as many books as I've been forcing myself to, you get a sense of the trends and the bigger themes and bigger ideas that are going on. So what I'd like to do is introduce you and start a conversation with you about some of these trends, of some of these themes and ideas that are coming across in the latest of the Jewish publishing world. And just for the record, for the audio or the video or whatever, my official title is a managing editor of OU Press. Director of Communications is someone else who's a wonderful gentleman. I wouldn't want to take his title away from him. So what we're going to do tonight is, and you should all know I'm not a very polished speaker. I have actually no idea how much time it'll take me to cover the material I have. I always over-prepare. So we're going to finish on time. We'll see how much we cover. And I have a mute button in case I really have to cough, so you won't have to bear through that. So what we're going to cover tonight is the trends and the ways people have been writing about halacha. And some in Hebrew, some in English. We'll go through some examples. But what I think is happening is there's a big shift going on in the world, and I want to bring it to your attention. And maybe someone will tell me that I'm totally wrong and I'm crazy. But I think it's very interesting, and I think it actually says a lot about where the community is going once you take a look at it and you think about it. So I'm going to be starting assuming that people have a basic working knowledge of Judaism and of Hebrew. Correct me if I'm wrong. Just let me know if there are any terms you don't understand. Feel free to chat. You know, what does that mean? I'm more than happy to stop. But my natural sure. Anybody has a question? Feel free to ask. Go ahead. I'm working with a BlackBerry. You can email me, but that's actually not the best. So just chat. Ask a question. Feel free. I'll stop for a second. Steve, I see you have a check mark next to you. Is that you raising your hand? Am I reading, understanding that correctly?
You are understanding it correctly, correct. That's the green thing. If you type on the bottom to raise your hand, to indicate asking you a question, but then they got to ask.
This is actually a good time to ask a question because we haven't actually technically gotten started yet. But I'll keep on talking, Steve, till you're ready. Again, so I'm assuming everybody has a working knowledge of Hebrew and Judaism. I'm going to speak comfortably. If you're uncomfortable with any terms, just shout out. Now Steve has a smiley face. Don't quite know what that means, but I'm smiling. I'll smile more. Is that what you want? okay, let's say you were a big Talmud Chacham. How would you communicate halacha to other people? So the way it's normally done is through classes, through lectures. You're a Rebbe Yeshiva. You teach. You talk to people. You're a rabbi, people come to you with questions, and you answer them. And then let's say you give a shiur in your shul. But if you want to put it in writing, how do you communicate that? How do you communicate the halacha to people in a way that they can understand and get the full feeling for it? Now, historically, there have been, let me just throw out, three different ways of doing it. One is the way the Rambam, who made it most famous, did it, and that's to put out a list of halachas organized by topic. So if you open up a Mishnah Torah has 14 sections, which is in itself interesting. The Rambam seemed to have an affinity for the number 14. If you look in the Mishnah Torah, there are 14 books. If you look in the Sefer HaMitzvot, there are 14 introductions. And if you look in the Mor Nevuchim, there are 14. The Rambam divides mitzvot into 14 different categories. Why? Don't know. He liked the number 14 for some reason. But anyway, so if you open up any one of the 14 books of the Mishnah Torah, you'll see by subject matter, subdivided within the book, you'll see just a list of halachas in order, in sensible order, but it's a list. And the Rambam didn't make this style up. We actually found it from Gaonim, who preceded him, never in as comprehensive a manner. The Rambam did it on the whole entire Torah. That's you know, hugely impressive. Nobody ever did that before, but they had done that style before. So the Rambam adopted that style, and it was very effective. Although people did criticize him. People criticized the Rambam for many things. But one of the criticisms is that all he did was he gave the list. All he did was he gave a list of the halachas. He didn't tell anybody where he got it from. Did he make it up? Which Gemara? And as we know, there are so many commentators and super commentators on the Rambam because not everything flows so smoothly from the Rambam. Not everything flows so smoothly. Pardon me, from the Gemara into the Rambam. So the fact that he didn't give sources and he didn't give the background, to some degree, that hampered it. On the other hand, it's very easy. When I was in yeshiva, so what I tried to do was I tried to pick out. You see, the way it works in YU, at least it used to, I don't know how it works anymore, was that MTA is a feeder high school directly into YU. And what a lot of kids did was they skipped the senior year of high school, and they went straight from junior year of high school into their first year of yeshiva and first year of college. Now, not everybody is 100% mature at that point in their time to take on the full responsibility of a dual curriculum in yeshiva college and YU. It was difficult, so what I used to do was I tried to find first-year guys who had skipped a year, you know, early admissions, and I would try to grab them, bring them to the Beis Medrash, you know, for half hour nights. I didn't want to impose too much. And what I'd do is I'd learn something simple with them. So what I would do is every night I would try to have a different early admissions guy who I would learn for half an hour of the Rambam, because the Rambam is simple. Anybody can understand it as long as you understand the Hebrew, because it's very clear and it really brings halacha out. And that's something that was a huge success. So on the one, they have the drawbacks, right? On the one hand, it's clear, it's easy, it's a list. And it's very clear and easy to understand. On the other hand, you have no sources, and so it's very easy to contradict him. And we'll, as we go forward, we'll see some other drawbacks of that. So there's a different way of doing it, which was done even before the Rambam also, and that is the way the Rif did it. And the way the Rif did it was he went through Gemaras, and he'd take a topic, he really followed the Gemara, but he quote all the Gemaras that are relevant to Halacha. So if you can learn the Gemara, you already know the Gemara, you can learn it very well. Also, as you read the Rif, you see how he paskened, how he ruled on any issue, based on which Gemaras he threw together and how he threw them together. And occasionally he put in some connective material. He, you know, made a few comments here and there. But generally speaking, it's just a list of Gemaras which lead to the conclusion of how he ruled. And it's actually very unwieldy unless you are yourself a Talmudic scholar. But this was a very popular style, ironically, in the Ashkenazic world. The Rif was a Sephardi, but in the Ashkenazic world, you know, centuries later, it became very popular. You had people like the Ravon, the Rav Yah, the Sefer HaEshkol, who was, I think it was in Provence. So it's another style, another way of doing things, which the Rambam intentionally deviated from. He wanted to do something simpler that people could understand. But on the other hand, the way of the Rif and the Ashkenazic Rishonim is very thorough and is intended for the scholars and has less input of the author himself. And then, of course, there's a third way, the middle path, which is to do a combination of both. And that's how I would characterize the tour. Now, the way the tour did it is he organized it by subject matter. He didn't go by Gemara, Masechta Gemara, whatever the Gemara covers, he would cover there. No, what he did is he did it by subject matters. For instance, Orach Chaim. He had four different categories. Orach Chaim, about daily life. Evan HaEzer, about women's issues. Chosha Mishpat, about business issues. And then Yoredeya, about what you might call ritual issues that don't really fit in anywhere else. And then within there, he put halachas. First, he started with, you know, Hilchas Hashkamas Adam Baboker, the halachas of waking up. You know, and then you have the halachas of brachas, the halachas of karbonos, the halachas of davening, of tzitzis, of tefillin. So he combined everything into sensible categories, subcategories of halachas. But within there, it's not a list of halachas. It's a discussion within each what he called a halacha. You might call a paragraph, here, quotation marks, a halacha. He has a discussion about what different recent opinions say. This Rishon said that, and this Rishon said that. So it's more of a discussion within the subcategories and very clearly defined parameters, not a list, a discussion, but within sort of the list parameters. So it's a combination. So like I said, that there really were three ways of doing it. One is a list, one is the throw all the Gemaras in and let your conclusion follow through, and the other is to combine them to dis- to delineate your halachas and then have a discussion within that. So now if we could skip about 1,000 years or so, let's go to the 20th century and come to where we're really going to talk about it, and that's more recent halacha, more recent Sfarim. How do they do it? So the way generally in the 20th century, the way it was done, the way I saw it done at least, was that it was kind of like the Shulchan Aruch and like the Rambam. You had books that were lists, and they were just lists of halachas, and then they have footnotes to them in Hebrew, sometimes in English. But the footnotes, gave the sources, and occasionally there was discussion. You know, not every sefer is the same. Not every book is the same. Some have better footnotes, some are worse, some are better organized, some are less better organized. But generally, that's how you had the halacha. So what I'm doing is that they give a list. This is the halacha A, B, C, D. And then you have footnotes giving sources and a little discussion. And I like to think of it more like the Mishnah Berurah. Because how does the Mishnah Berurah set up? It follows the Shulchan Aruch. But what it has in the bottom, as the Mishnah Berurah commentary, is it gives you the halachas, maybe a few other opinions, a few other circumstances that aren't discussed in the Shulchan Aruch itself. And then to that, you have the sources and the footnotes of the Shahar Ziyun. And any more complicated situations are discussed on the side in the Bir Halacha. But essentially, it's a list book. It follows the Shulchan Aruch and follows that list and just adds more lists, sub-lists, to those lists. And that is generally how I saw the Halacha Svarim and the Halacha books in the early 20th century were following that. In the 80s, right, when I grew up, and that's when Art Scroll was still relatively new, it was just ramping up. So what kind of Halacha Svarim did you have? So what I recall was the standard was Rabbi Shimon Eider, from Lakewood. He had these, typed. It was before you had word processing, so it was really typed, and it was copied in a printer, a local printer, not in a book printer where it's all nicely done and bound. This was the kind of thing that was done in a local printer, and then stapled together, and what was actually called saddle stitched together. These were lists. It was went by topic, went by list, and then it had footnotes in Hebrew or English, and also in those days you had these great English books by Rabbi Pinchas Bodner, I think also of Lakewood. He had a Brachos book, and he had a Muksa book. Yes, someone pointed out privately that Rabbi Eider did learn at YU at one point, but he ended up in Lakewood, and he was probably the country's biggest, or one of the biggest experts in Erevin, but that's all beside the point. Let's not get into politics or anything like that. Rabbi Eider was a wonderful, wonderful man. So Rabbi Pinchas Bodner, I remember his books were great for among other reasons, because he wrote it at a time where some of the great poskim of the previous generation were still alive. So if you look in his book, and especially in the back of his books, you see he actually discussed the issues with Rav Moshe Feinstein, with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and they gave him detailed responses. So in that sense, and some of it they wrote themselves, so in some way it's a primary source, maybe even a secondary source from some of the great poskim of the previous generation. And in that sense, these are invaluable material, but they're also very clear and very helpful and very useful, but again, they're lists. So what's the worst thing about a book of lists? Can anyone tell me that? It's very simple. They're extremely boring. You can't sit down and read it. You cannot sit down and read a book of lists from beginning to end, because you will fall asleep before you do that. See, Menachem Butler is avidly typing that I can't even keep up with all his points. There are, of course, exceptions, and he missed the most obvious exception, which I'll get to in a minute, in a few minutes. Yes, we're speaking in generalities, of course. And so I'd like to start off by discussing one book of lists, which I found extremely helpful, and I think is one of the most important books on Hilchos Shabbos that are around, despite the fact that it is a book of lists, and therefore I've never gone through a full chapter because I find it extremely non-stimulating. And that is the Shmiras Shabbos Kehilchosa by Rabbi Shua Neuwirth. He did it in Hebrew, and it's been translated into English, at least some of it. And in it, what he does is he goes through all the relevant issues of Shabbos in extreme, extreme detail that apply to the, when he was writing, it was 1980s and the 1990s. What he did was he dealt with all the contemporary, very difficult issues that have to do with electricity, really relevant things, motion detectors, all those things that we deal with in Shabbos on every week. He went through and he investigated and he put together a great book with nice little lists and summaries in Hebrew, and then at the bottom the footnotes are extremely important because they give you all the sources of where you can find things. And it, probably the most important thing is all his personal discussions that he had with the Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, with whom he was very close. And you have a lot of original ideas and rulings from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach contained in those footnotes. Some of them radical and very surprising, and they all have, both volumes. I think maybe there's even a third or fourth volume. I only have two. I have indexes. Actually, I don't find, someone asked if he finds it relatively disorganized. I don't find that at all. You just have to understand his organization, how he's doing it, and how he starts off, and he starts, you know, and he has the chapter topics, and the chapters are very relevant. Cooking, muksa, toys. There is some overlap from chapter to chapter, but in general, he gives you everything you need to know. Now, I just want to give one example. I actually have here the English Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata. I also have the Hebrew one. The English one is one that I got when I got married. Well, you know, as you get married, you gain new books. So one of the sets that I got was Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata in English. So let me just read you some halachas. And just so you know, for the future, in future weeks, I will be having some sort of presentation that you can read out together. Just today, I've been sick, and I didn't really put it together in advance. So I apologize for that. Let me just read you one halacha. This is in chapter 26, halacha 19. It talks about going on grass on Shabbos, which when I was a kid, that used to bother me, because whenever I would walk to shul, I would cut across the lawn of the town. It was in Teaneck there, the library and the town hall right next to each other, and that was directly my way to shul, so I'd walk through the grass, and I would always be stepping on twigs, breaking things, and it always bothered me, how's that mutter? So I once asked that to one of my friends who happened to be a big Talmud Chacham and is currently now a very big Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Daniel Feldman, and he said, no, it's mutter, and I said, I don't think so, I think it's got to be usher somehow, and he said, he's pretty sure it's mutter, and he was right. So let me read to you the halacha as it is in this book. So this is paragraph 19, subparagraph A. One is allowed to walk on a lawn on Shabbat or Yom Tov, regardless of the possibility that one may thereby pull up or tear off clumps or blades of grass. So you can walk on the grass, even if you're wearing shoes that might pull up grass, which is you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Nevertheless, is subparagraph B, any pieces of grass or vegetation which one does not find stuck to one's shoes should not be removed in the normal way with one's hand, since they are muksa. So you can't just pick things up and move them away because it's muksa. You have to do it in an unusual way. Subparagraph C, if the grass is long, one should walk slowly and should certainly not run, as one would be bound to pull up or tear off some of the grass in this way. So anything that you do that would definitely cause grass to be uprooted or definitely cause something else, which is usur, so then you're not allowed to do that. That's what's called sikresha in halacha. It will definitely happen. But if you're walking and it may or may not happen, so that's allowed. So subparagraph D, one should not tread on dry thistles, which are still attached to the ground, because they will definitely break off. So something that's attached to the ground, if you step on it, and it will definitely break off, so you're not allowed to do that on Shabbos either. So if it'll definitely break off, so that's also you're not allowed to walk on that. Let me just read to you one more paragraph, paragraph 20. It is permitted to sit or lie on grass. You're allowed to lie down on the grass, go to the park on Shabbos. Subparagraph B, one is similarly allowed to spread a blanket or mat on a lawn and sit on that. You can put a blanket on the grass. You can have a picnic in your backyard. Or you could lie down on a blanket on the backyard. C, one may even move grass, which is connected to the ground to and fro, provided one takes care not to detach it. So you can move grass back and forth, you just can't pull it out. So we'll just end here. And my real point in reading this is that, number one, it's very useful and helpful. Number two, it's very detailed. It goes into a lot of details. Every possible scenario you might think of, or almost every, I'm sure Menachem can come up with some others. But it's not very user-friendly in the fact that you can't just read it through from cover to cover because it's too much. It's overwhelming. It's a great reference book, something you want in your library, which is I have the Hebrew and the English in my library. But it's a unique style that is very difficult to digest. It's very thorough. If I had to describe it in one word, it's thorough. Thorough good and thorough bad. So let's move on to another type, which is a variation on that list, but a slight, I think, a much more user-friendly variation. I got married in 1994. So it was a good year to get married in YU because Rabbi Mordechai Willig had a number of Talmidim getting married, and they convinced him to give a Chatan Shir to teach us the laws of Nidus. Even though I wasn't directly a student of his, he gave the Shir and opened up to anyone who was getting married. So I had the privilege of learning Hilchos Nida for a Chatan with him. So we all expected the most important thing that every Chatan wants to know is the Herchakos. You know, what are you allowed to do, what are you not allowed to do? He actually spent very little time on that, and I'll explain the Herchakos a little more detail in a minute. He spent most of the time on more general ideas of Hilchos Nida, which, to me, I found I was very disappointed in that, but only later in life I realized how valuable it is to have learned that under such a master like him, and to have his experience. And what he did with, when it came to Herchakos, he gave one shir on Herchakos, with Rabbi Danny Rapp sitting right next to him, shepherding him with a lot of questions. It was quite an experience. And what he did at the end of the shir is he said, if you had any more questions, we're always welcome to ask him. But he highly recommended one sefer on the Herchakos, and that is, I'm showing it to you right here, called Suga Bashoshanim. It's written by a Belzer Dayan in Eretz Yisrael, published in 1978. The author is Rabbi, let me just look it up here, Shmuel Eliyahu Vind. I don't know who he is, never heard of him, Belzer Dayan. From what I can tell from the sefer, it is extremely good. It's a fabulous sefer. The way he does it is, again, he does a list, like we've been talking about, a list of the halachos, and on the bottom he has a commentary that gives the sources, but he doesn't just list the sources. He actually goes through it from beginning, from the bare basics, through from the Gemara. He explains what is relevant in any given Gemara, and then explains how the Rishonim understood that, and then he shows the different views in the Rishonim, and then from there he goes to the Acharonim. He shows you the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch, and then he goes into the Lamdas, which is the greatest part. He goes into really the conceptual ideas and conceptual differences between the different views, and then shows you where he reaches his conclusion. This is a book full of conclusions. It must be this kind of book, and it gives you all the conclusions you need. It's actually fairly lenient on many, many issues. That's another reason to recommend it, if that's your style. But he shows you where he gets it from. So it's really a geshmak. If you learn in yeshiva, it's a very geshmak sefer, where you just read the top in the Hebrew, it gives you the brief ideas, and then the bottom gives you all the lumdus and all the rishonim and everything you need to know. And not only that, he didn't stop there. In the back, because again, this is a book of lists, and it's very hard to go through the whole thing in one sitting, in the back he gives you lists of halachos that are relevant to different situations. So he has a kitzer dinim lechasan, so for the chasan, after he gets married, he has just a short, brief list of the rulings of the halachas that are relevant for the chas. And again, this is a sefer Suga Bashoshanim. It seems to be self-published in 1978 by Rabbi Eliyahu Shmuel Vind, 1978 in Yerushalayim, Belzer Dayan. Excellent. And he has a number of these summaries in the back that are relevant for different people, different times. Seder v'dinei habedikos, which is relevant to women at certain times. Dinei v'seder ashiva nikim, for those seven clean days. I'm not going to go into that, but the halachas are relevant for that. So what are the herchakos? Before we continue anymore, hopefully nobody's lost, but just in case. So when a woman is a nida, so her husband and she and her husband are not to have relations. That's an iser kares if they do. And they're not allowed, either the Raisa or the Rabbana, to come anywhere near that, which means nothing remotely risque between the two. But in addition to that, there are dinim de Rabbana, and there are rabbinical rules that they're not allowed to even come close to that, which means they're not allowed to, for example, to touch each other even in non-risque ways. They're not allowed to pass things one to the other. They're not allowed to eat on the same plate, on the same table, sit on the same bench. So again, you know, all these halachas have been developed over time, and they're different positions and different customs and traditions. It's, you know, if you're not familiar with these, it's appropriate to find out from your rabbi or your spiritual mentor where you should be in terms of these. I'm surprised this summer someone told me his wife was learning Hilchos Nida, a review with an older woman, and the older woman said, "Oh yeah, my rabbi told me we don't have to do those herchakos." I've never heard such a thing. I guess there are different customs in different communities. Seems to me these are binding halachas. But if, you know, find out what your local custom is. But let me just go through one halacha here, and you'll get a feel for his style and I'm keeping an eye on the clock, so I'm going to move a little quicker because we have a lot more material to cover. So the first the halacha we're going to cover, it has to do with eating on the same plate and the same table. So in Perek Dalet, the fourth chapter, the first paragraph, Baal v'ishto kishehi benidasa, so a husband and a wife when she is a nida, asurim la'achol be'yachad be'ka'ar achas, they're not allowed to eat together on the same plate. Ulukuling alma lomahani b'zeh heter shelasiyas heker be'emsa ha'ka'ara. So there's a bit of a loophole here, and that is that some posts can allow for in certain cases. When you put something on the table to differ, and we'll discuss why, when you put something on the table to make it clear that this is a unique situation and you're both a heker, is something you both recognize and you'll realize and you remember that something's different here, so that helps in certain situations. But if you're eating from the same plate, he says that the heker does not help. Even though they make sure that they don't take food from the plate at the same time, you know, each will take turns, that still doesn't help. They only eat one after the other, that doesn't work. And then he brings you in parentheses, so in the Shach, and then the Torah, and then he shows you exactly where he gets it from. Now, we're just skipping ahead to paragraph 9, and we'll go through a little of these halachos, and then we'll talk in the footnotes. You'll see how great the footnotes are, because it's really, really fabulous sefer. So, Achila Mika'ara Achas, Nikres, Rak Bishnehem Ochlin Bevasachas. So, here's the question. You're not allowed to eat from the same plate. So, you have two questions here. Number one, what does it mean to eat? Number two, what does it mean to a plate? And as you can imagine, none of these things are without debate. So, well, let's just discuss the definition of eating a little bit. So, what does it mean to eat together? So, eating from the same plate is called even Rak Bishnehem Ochlin Bevasachas, if they're eating at the same time, not literally both picking food off at the same time, but they're eating, the food is in their mouth, and they're in the process of eating at the same time. Or each one takes a piece, I take a piece, you take a piece, I take a piece. That's also considered eating at the same time. Aval, however, im ochel habal levad, if the husband is eating alone, kodim, before, vegomar kol ochel shebekar, and he finishes everything on a plate, she could take the plate, put her food on it, and eat from that plate. That's not considered eating at the same time. And also reverse, when the woman ate everything in the plate, he could put his food onto that plate and then eat from there. That's not considered eating at the same time. Again, we'll go through the lumdus in about a minute. Paragraph Yud 10 Isra Achila Bekara Achas Hu Afilu Kishesh Bekara Shnei Mine Ochlim. Even it's still considered eating. Again, we're talking about the definition of eating. Even if there are two different types of food on the plate, V'abal Ochla Min Echad, and the husband is eating one type of food, V'aish Ochla Esmi Min Hasheni, and the woman is eating the other type of food, we're still within the same definition of the definition of forbidden eating on the same plate. Okay, Yud Aleph. Nira dimutar mishnehim litom hamachalim v'hatafshilin im chaso behem melech o eze tavlin. So what about tasting? You want to know, does it taste right? Does it have enough spices in it? Does it have enough salt in it? So he says, that tasting is not considered eating. Again, we're defining eating as a tasting to see whether it has the right taste. That's not considered eating. So that there's no prohibition on that whatsoever. So those are three paragraphs in which he discusses, and you can see, he goes through every possible scenario and definitions, and which can be tiresome. Again, we're talking about a book of lists, and he goes through every detail, and it can be tiresome to go through the whole thing. But to break it up, or really to give more his proof and his sources, is where he goes through the sources on the bottom and the footnotes. So I'm not going to go through all these footnotes together. I took a few notes on this, and I'll just give you the short version of it. So, for example, he quotes the three-way machlokas rishonim. He quotes the Rambam, who says the only thing eating is if it's on the same plate. If the food is on the same plate, then it's aser. Why is eating together on the same plate aser? So he brings a reason given by the Rambam and the Rush, and that's because eating together is considered, again, you're alone in a room, which is you're not normally allowed to be with other women, but because this woman is your wife, a wife and a husband are allowed to be together in the same room. So when you're in the room together, think of a romantic evening. So even if this romantic, even this evening is not that romantic, there's some sort of ambiance that could be there, and because of that, that eating itself could be problematic. and therefore you're not allowed to eat together on the same plate. And because of this possible romantic atmosphere. The Ravid and the Ravia have a totally different reason. They say, no, the reason is because you're used to eating together. That's how you eat every single night together. And because you're used to it, it could lead to touching, which is asur. So according to the Rambam and the Rosh, the eating itself is forbidden because it has that chiba, that romantic ambiance might have. But according to the Ravid and the Ravia, it's not that it's inherently asur, but that it could lead to something asur. And therefore, according to the Rambam and the Rosh, let's say you put something on the table right in front of you to remind both of each other, that she's in a situation where she's a nida. According to the Rambam and Rosh, it doesn't matter. She's already asur. I mean, the eating itself is already asur, so putting a heker there, putting a sign, won't help. But according to the Ravid and the Ravya, it will help. And then there's a third view, which we're not going to get into now because I see we've got to keep moving. Interestingly enough, the Tor combines, again, this is from the footnotes, the Tor combines the views of the Rambam and the Rosh and the Ravid and the Ravya and says, if you're eating on a small table together, even if it's not the same plate, so then a heker will not work. But if you're eating on a big table, which is pretty much what we all eat on today, you know, in the times of the Gemara, they ate on small tables, which are really one-person tables, it's like a plate. And nowadays, we eat on big tables. So if you eat on a big table, so then a heker will work following the Ravid and the Rav Yah. And then the footnotes go through the Achronim, the Shach, and the Darchei Tshuva. And he discusses what's eating, what's the definition of eating. And then he shows how he deduced his conclusion. So for instance, we talked about tasting. Tasting is not a problem. So why is tasting not a problem? What's the proof? So he doesn't go into the lumps, but he gives a proof. The proof is he quotes a tshuva from Reb Shlomo Kluger in the early 1800s. He said that if a woman tastes from food, just to see if it tastes well, which is, you know, say she cooks dinner, she wants to make sure it tastes well. Someone asked if I could hold this inside of the safer, no problem. There you go. I don't know if you can see it that well. Again, I apologize for not having any handouts or anything like that. So Reb Shlomo Kluger said that if a woman cooks something, she takes a bit of a taste to make sure it tastes good, and then she gives it to her husband, that's no problem. So then the Suga B'Shoshanim deduces from there that tasting is not considered eating. So if either the husband or the wife tastes, it's still mutter, it's still all right for the woman to eat. So again, what we have here is we have a step away from the list. He starts as a list, but then he moves away. It's not like the Shmiras Shabbos Kehilchos or Rabbi Eider, where it's a list, and then the footnotes are a list also. It's really a list, and then on the bottom you have more of a discussion, more of a shir, if you could say, that a Rebbe or a Rabbi might give to his congregants or to his students about where it all comes from, building it up from the sources, building it up to halacha as it is today. So that's already, you might call it a transition kind of book that's in between different styles. So now I want to move on to, I think what we all want to, what I consider to be a relatively new type of, or at least a growing type, genre really, is halachic prose. And I first heard this term in the name of Rabbi Soloveitchik, that he wanted to create this new genre, which truthfully existed beforehand, but he wanted to grow this genre of halachic prose, and that's why the style he chose for his book called Shiurim L'Zecher Abba Mori, there are two volumes of Yahrzeit lectures. He used to give a lecture every year on the Yahrzeit of his father, which were packed and fascinating, and they still have recordings of it. And so his two sons-in-law, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein and Rabbi Yitzhak Tursky, wrote many of them up and published them in two volumes called Shiurim L'Zecher Abba Mori. And there's a very unique style to it. As you read it, you see it's not a normal yeshivish sefer. It's in modern Hebrew, and it progresses. It's not the old style of this and that. And he has a private, he has the questions, and then he gives some background, and then he goes and he tries to answer up the questions. Now, to me, the whole title, Halachic Prose for Shiurim L'Zecher Abba Mori, is a little bit of a misnomer, because it's not halacha. Really, it's sugyas, it's really lomdus, it's really complicated topics. He goes through topics, he doesn't really go through halacha. If you read that book, you will not, any given chapter, you will not come out of it with what the halacha is. It's more about halacha, and about the sources, and about the ideas. However, others have taken that idea, even before Rabbi Soloveitchik, and certainly afterwards, and really taken it to a new level. And I'll give you the biggest example. I believe, yeah, someone asked if Rabbi Soloveitchik looked over the Sefer himself. I'm almost 100% sure that he did. It was certainly published in his lifetime by his two sons-in-law. I think the two volumes were published at different times, but even still, I believe, certainly at least the first volume, but again, I don't know. It's just my vague recollection. So who did Menachem Butler and always list in the chat? Who did he leave out? And I'm always picking on him because he put down a really good list in there. But who did he leave out? He left out Reb Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Rabbi Zevin wrote a number of very, very fascinating sefarim. I'm not going to pick on one right now, and that's Hamo'adim B'Halacha, in which his goal, which he states in the introduction, is not to teach you the halacha of the Yom Tovim and what to do on the Yontifs, but to go through, someone points out that Rabbi Soloveitchik's Shirim Lodech Abba Mori are about halacha as opposed to agada, but not halacha, practical halacha. It's a good point. So Rav Zevin, what he does in Hamo'adim B'Halacha is he goes through the Yom Tovim and picks out topics of halacha that are relevant to that yontif, and then he goes, talks about them in beautiful, beautiful Hebrew. I mean, it's remarkable how clear he is and how beautiful his language is. Really a great author, and he brings out the ideas, and he goes through sometimes Rishonim, sometimes Achronim, concepts, sometimes sources, sometimes unusual, a great question and then a great answer, which really gives you a great geschmack. Beautiful, beautiful two volumes. I think there's also one volume edition. Can someone beat me to it? There's an art scroll translation of Rav Zevin's Hamo'adim B'Halacha. They took out one sentence, which is controversial, and when he's talking about, I think it's Tisha B'Av, or the halachas regarding the Zecher L'Chorban, and whether they tear Kriya over Yerushalayim, and he mentions that now that we have a country, a state in Israel, and says Ashreinu Shezachinu L'Chach, you know, praiseworthy are meritorious of us, that we were able to see it. So what happened was, and this came out in the tradition when it was criticized, Art Scroll took out that sentence where he mentions how meritorious we are to see the state of Israel, but it turns out his family requested that, came out in an exchange of letters in the journal Tradition, and someone involved in the editorial there told me that he actually saw the documents, or he was in touch with the people, and he's confirmed that the family requested that it be taken out. So it's not Art Scroll who took it out, although they do have a really great translation, and I recommend it. There's nothing wrong with it. Okay, people are saying it's a lie. I don't know. I suggest you contact the editorial staff at Tradition. That's who I talk to. But regardless, I see Rabbi Zevin's works as really the most beautiful. Okay, someone spoke to Rabbi Zevin's son and said it's not Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, I assume. I don't know. Okay, regardless, we're talking about one sentence in a two-volume book. The two-volume book is great. The Hebrew is beautiful. If you can read Hebrew, read it. Don't read the English. If you can't, I highly recommend the English anyway. So what we have there is something that's easy to read. You can sit on a Shabbos afternoon. You can go through, they're not bite-sized pieces, but they're relatively short essays on interesting topics. Really, it's appropriate for Yontif. But if you have four Shabbos before any Yontif, except for Sukkot, it gets complicated, but whatever. Read it in advance. You could read the short essays. It's beautiful. And that's what I call halachic prose. Halachic prose, I believe, is growing in popularity now. And let me give you the names of two really great halachic prose writers who we're not going to discuss tonight. But two of them are, number one, Rabbi J. David Bleich, and number two, Rabbi Chaim Jachter. Rabbi J. David Bleich writes a regular column on recent contemporary halacha in the journal Tradition, and he has a few other articles, and he's put them together so far into five volumes called Contemporary Halachic Problems, Classics, beautiful, brilliant, very difficult to read, though. His English is academic English, and it's not for everybody. He has other books, Menachem just pointed out, his Bioethical Dilemmas, he has Healing in Judaism, he does have a number of works, he's a brilliant man, but again, these are, his writing is a bit complex. I wouldn't recommend it to everybody. Rabbi Jachter has a much simpler English. I was actually involved in one of the publication of one of his volumes. He has three volumes right now called Gray Matter. Highly recommended, but again, we're not going to go into detail now. He takes different subjects and discusses them and shows you some of the ideas and how the contemporary post, it's really a book about contemporary halacha and how the contemporary authorities rule on them and why they do. Includes a lot of what you might call modern Orthodox or religious Zionist halacha also. Rabbi Chaim Jankter will be speaking for Torah in Motion in Toronto. Someone asked about Rabbi Asher Weiss. I don't have that much familiarity with him, but from what I understand, from what I've seen, it's brilliant, beautiful, but very traditional yeshiva charade in his farm. I'm not saying anything bad about it, Chas v'Shalom. I think it's brilliant and beautiful, but really not what we're talking about. In the same category of Rabbi Asher Weiss, I would probably put Rabbi Yitzchak Sarutzkin in many of his books, but again, we're going way off topic now. So I want to bring up two more English books before we get to the final Hebrew book, and we're actually running out of time, so I'll move a little quicker, but I would be remiss if I did not show you, there are two books. I'll show you one by Rabbi Daniel Z. Feldman, who I believe has spoken for Torah Motion in the past. This is his most recent book called, I'm blocking the title here, Divine Footsteps, published by Yeshiva University Press. Came out earlier this year. He had a previous book that was in two editions, The Right and the Good. I actually published the second edition of that first book. He does halachic prose also, but he does the halachic prose differently. He does, two things are different. Number one, he deals almost entirely, yes, he has three volumes of Bina B'Svarim, Rabbi Feldman, three books in Hebrew, Menachem distracted me. So what Rabbi Daniel Feldman does differently is that his books are about interpersonal mitzvot, number one. So the first one is all about different kinds of interpersonal mitzvot. Can you insult people? Can you, can you use nicknames? Attacking people, assaulting people. And the second one is all about chesed, which we're going to talk about shortly. That's number one thing that he does differently is when he talks about contemporary halacha, he talks about the halachas that we often forget about, sadly, that contemporary times. I don't know if it was any different any other time, but certainly contemporary times we don't always recognize. And one of his goals is to bring out that halacha has a lot to say about these things. And I think it's a beautiful idea. And his English is stunning. It's beautiful. Yeah, he is an author. He's not just someone who knows halacha who writes. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But he's someone who knows halacha and knows how to write. He went to college, so Baruch Hashem, he had a good education and can write well. So let's talk about... So one of the other things he does differently is that he deals mainly with lomdus. Now, if you know him, if you heard some of his lectures, and also some of the lectures of a few people who are a few years older than him, I remember I was in yeshiva at the same time with him, some of the older influences, number one, primary among them, was Rabbi Tzvi Sobolovsky, who used to give a weekly chabura Thursday night. This is when he was single, living, learning in the kollel. He would give a chabura, which was fabulous, and the way he did it, and this is the way Rabbi Feldman, in his own way, does it, taking his own style, is he goes through the Achronim, the most recent Sfarim, the most recent literature, and discusses the concepts behind them and how, conceptually, they address all these different topics. So when you go to Mitzvot Bein Adam L'Chavera, what he shows you is, number one, there's a huge literature, a very recent vintage, that discusses it. Now, he mines it out. He finds the responsa here, the responsa there, and the commentary here and there. It's beautiful. And what he does is he goes through any given mitzvah, any given topic, and he analyzes it and shows really the analyses in a logical progression that really anybody could read if your English is good enough, which from the yeshiva world it might be a problem for people who don't have a great command of English, but most people I think here have a good enough command of English that you could read it, and it's incredible and it's inspiring and it's very important. So let's give an idea. Let me give an example from last week's parsha. As we quickly run out of time, I'll actually be very quick here, and I apologize for that. I'm not leaving much time for questions, but next week will be better, I hope. Hachnasas Orchim. So last week, in the beginning of the parsha, Vayira Alav Hashem. Hashem comes to Avram, and then the next pasuk already, Avram is entertaining three guests. So what happened? So Rashi tells us from Chazal, from the sages, that entertaining guests and is more important than receiving the divine present and speaking to Hashem, which is incredible statement about the importance of treating guests properly. The question is, why? Why, of all the interpersonal... mitzvahs. Why about that about any other interpersonal mitzvah? So Rabbi Feldman quotes the author of Kelm, who said that any other interpersonal mitzvah, there's really nothing that you're giving personally. It's more you're speaking kindly to someone. You're treating someone a little better. But when it comes to Achnosis Orchim, you're bringing them into your home and you're actually losing. And one way or another, you are giving, if not financially, you're certainly losing your time. And for that, it's greater than any other interpersonal mitzvah. Now, interestingly, he points out, the Rambam quotes Hachnasas Orchim, not only the mitzvah, which you'd expect in the Mishnah Torah, which is all about halacha, but the Rambam also quotes this this saying from the sages that greeting guests is more important than greeting God, which is surprising. Why would that be in halacha? It's a great statement of you know, biblical exegesis and moral, but why would it be in a halacha book? So the Baal Shem Tov had a great answer for that. The Baal Shem Tov, again, Rabbi Feldman quoting, said that your own spiritual needs, your own learning, your own growth has to be put secondary to inviting guests over. And I'm sure you've all had this experience where you have guests over on a Shabbos. And maybe they're not the most religious people. Maybe they don't have the greatest divrei Torah. Maybe their speech might go on to inappropriate topics and it makes you uncomfortable. But so the Baal Shem Tov is telling us from this Rambam, we see that nevertheless, your own personal spiritual growth is not as important as greeting these guests and treating them properly and having them over for a meal and or for other respects. Let's move on, because even though there's so much more in this book, it is a great example of halachic prose. I want to move on to two more books. One is by my friend Rabbi Ari Enkin. He has two books. This is the most recent one. It's called, again, I'm covering the title, Amot Shel Halacha. His previous book was Dalet Amot. And he takes halachic prose to another stage. Yes, a little chassidus, surprising as it is for me. So Rabbi Enkin takes it to another stage. And his halachic prose is not in beautiful English. It's not polished English. I shouldn't say it's not beautiful, because it is easy to read. What Rabbi Enkin goes for is easy to read. He wants people from whatever background, however limited it may be, however extensive it may be, both in Jewish subjects and in English, he wants to create easy-read halacha, to get you excited about it. The people could sit back on a busy Shabbos afternoon when they're exhausted after a long week, they can open it up, read a bite-sized essay on halacha, and get excited about it, go from beginning to end, learn something new, and get interested in other subjects. So he gives a lot of footnotes where you can find more things, you can find out more information about the topic, but his goal really is to titillate a little bit, to get you excited. And I've just in this book, Amot Shel Halacha, is a chapter on Hachnasas Orchim. So one of the interesting things that Rabbi Feldman talks about, which I didn't get to, is that because Hachnasas Orchim is so important, there are leniencies in Halacha that allow you to set aside certain stringencies and even certain rules in order to accommodate your Hachnasas Orchim. So let me quote you, let me just read to you what Rabbi Enkin has to say about that. It is interesting to note that there are a number of Halachot whose regulations are relaxed in honor of guests. For example, many authorities who ordinarily prohibit one to make ice cubes on Shabbat will permit doing so in the event that they are needed for guests, and by extension to better enhance one's Shabbat. In other words, if you have guests over and you normally wouldn't make ice cubes on Shabbos, which I wouldn't, some people would, they'd allow it, but if you have guests over, it's allowed, because even though it might be Asar Midirabbanan, because of Hachnasas Orchim, they allow you to be lenient on that. It is also permitted to manually exert oneself to rearrange a room in order for guests to sleep comfortably, something otherwise forbidden on Shabbat. You got to move your couch around and your chairs around, and it's difficult. It's difficult to do, and you normally shouldn't be doing that on Shabbos, but if you have guests and they need a place to stay, Baruch Hashem. And so too, in the event that one is pressed for time when kashering meat in preparation for cooking, one is permitted to shorten the required salting time if the meat is being served in honor of guests. Not too relevant nowadays, I would say, but there are people who do kasher meat, and you're allowed to be lenient there also. It's especially important to be sure to include guests at holiday meals. So as just another zinger, make sure to invite guests over, and this is really just one paragraph from a long chapter, actually not so long chapter, which is the point, on Hachnasas Orchim. Now, again, so I'm getting lost in some of the details here because I overprepared and we're running short on time. But my point here is that there's a growing literature of halachic prose in which people take halacha and take some of the concepts behind it. Rabbi Feldman specializes in conceptual ideas. Rabbi Enkin specializes in interesting ideas and puts them together into a running prose, which you can read from beginning to end, that's not a list of lists, but is rather a book. It's like a novel. Well, not quite a novel, but it's a prose that you could read from beginning to end. Now, the real thing that I wanted to talk about was this book called Yesodei HaTzedakah by Rabbi Menachem Kasdan, a recent book on tzedakah, which is remarkable for a number of reasons. It is in the same style, so we don't run out of time. I just want to tell you, it's the same style of Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon of Yeshivat Har Etzion, who's written some books on halacha. He has one on Shemitah, he has one on Erev Pesach, the falls down on Shabbos. And yes, most of these books I have talked about on my blog. Yesodei HaTzedakah I talked about on my blog recently. And Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon has a very interesting book, which I personally found fascinating. And that is a book of halacha for soldiers, which basically goes through the entire relevant halachas. You could call it Kitzur Shulchan Aruch for soldiers. Soldiers have a lot of relevant halachas that he had to cover in a short book. And Rabbi Rimon went from beginning to end, from the early sources, takes you through Gemara. It was written for Bnei Torah. It was written for yeshiva graduates of his own yeshiva, of Yeshivat Har Etzion. And it really takes a Ben Torah who wants to know some of the meat and bones, some of what's it all about, and shows him how he reaches his conclusions. Fascinating, very important. So in this Yesodei HaTzedakah, one of the most interesting things that Rabbi Kasdan does is he starts with, brace yourselves, a halacha book that starts with the actual verses, with the psukim. He starts with the psukim, and he points out some analogies, anomalies in Parshas Re'eh, where it lists the halachas of tzedakah. For example, there's certain repetitions. Why does it say Pasoach Tiftach? You should open your hand. And then it says Noson Titen? You should surely give. You know, it's a bit of a redundancy. Why does it say Lo Se'amez Lavavcha? You shouldn't harden your heart to someone who is poor. It also says Lo Sikbos Tzadcha. You shouldn't close your hand to a poor person who comes to you. So why do you have all these anomalies in the Pesukim that discuss it? And he goes from there to the commentators on the Torah, the Pshat commentators, and he goes from there to the Gemaras, to Chazal, and he goes from there to the Rishonim, and then to the Acharonim, and to the Halacha Lamaisa. He takes you from, literally from step, all the way, the first step, to the very last step. And in between, he shows you the Lumdus. He shows you some of the concepts behind it, and explains to you what goes behind it. I had an example, but it's 5 to 10, we have no time left. I apologize for that. I just want to add a few notes before we open it up to questions. I don't know if there will be any questions because there's been a lot of typing as we go along. Maybe I could respond to some of the comments that we've had up till now, but I just want to point out, Art Scroll does have some very good books. I'll give you two examples. One is the Art Scroll Cholamod book, which you could probably, is pretty close to prose, halachic prose, as Art Scroll gets. It's really a fabulous book, and each chapter you could really read, there's a bit of a storyline there, if you'll allow me my exaggeration, but it's really, it's not a list as much as something you could read that flows through. I think that was great, and then it has footnotes. I'm not trying to say that halachic prose is now the dominant force. I'm saying it's a growing force. I mean, we recently had a book of lists published by Rabbi David Ribia, the 39 Melachos on Hilchos Shabbos, which is a fabulous book, 4 thick volumes. Now, granted, the font is very large and the paper thick, so maybe it shouldn't be 4 thick volumes. Maybe you could do it in 3. But regardless, it's monumental, fabulous book. Very difficult to get through because there's just so much, and every possible scenario you could think of is in there. So it's a great reference, but it's not something like Rabbi Kasdan's book or Rabbi Feldman's book that you could just read through from beginning to end. So I just want to make one point where we started before. We were talking about a book of lists, and I compared it to the Mishnah Berurah. We have a commentary on Shulchan Aruch that really just shows more halachos, and then he has footnotes and a side, the Bir Halacha, where he discusses complicated situations. The prose, I think, fits more the Aruch HaShulchan style. If you ever read the Aruch HaShulchan, what he does is every halacha, he follows the Shulchan Aruch, but what he does is gives you an introduction, shows you the relevant Gemaras, the relevant points in the Rishonim, and then the Shulchan Aruch, and then the Achronim, and then he reaches his conclusion however he rules like, and you can see from beginning to end in any given halacha, there is a progression that is very readable. From what I understand, some of it's been translated into English but not published yet. Hopefully we'll see that soon. I look forward to that. But what I would say is that the transition now is from the Mishneh Berurah style to the Shulchan Aruch style. The Shulchan Aruch Harav is just like the Shulchan Aruch, really. Someone asked that. I wouldn't consider it any different. Beautiful, brilliant, very important sefer. I have a copy, but it's, I don't see it as any different than really the Shulchan Aruch, just with his own points. I just want to get back to one thing Menachem mentioned here. I don't want anyone to get the wrong impression. He said the harchokos between a husband and wife are relaxed in front of guests. Depends who you ask, but yes, it also in front of your own family when you have children around, there might be leniencies there also. If you learned harchokos by Rabbi Willig, so you might have leniencies. If you learned by someone else, you might not. You should ask. If anyone has any questions, now is a good time to ask because we're almost done here. I'm not quite sure how to end it. I see Jay just came on now. I'm just scrolling back through the comments. Rabbi Bleich has written a lot about bioethics, about philosophy. He actually has a PhD in Jewish philosophy on the Ralbag. He has a book on Gersonides. He also wrote a book on Birkat Hachama, which is going to be, you don't have the full curriculum of the next 2 weeks, 2 months, but one, we're going to have a whole class on Birkat Hachama. It's going to be great. You guys are going to love it. Some of my comments on the Birkat Hachama book, I actually, before it was published, actually it was before, after the second volume was published, I called up Rabbi Bleich to ask him a question, and in a shir he later gave, he took back something that he wrote there, or he revised it a little bit. But anyway, I think it's time to relatively sign off, unless anyone has any other questions. Thank you all for staying on for this long, and for listening, and for participating. It's a great experience for me. I hope you all enjoyed it also, and come back next week.
Thank you. Okay, have a good night, everybody. And we'll see you around, everybody, we hope, for this and many other classes. Brought to you live on the E-Team Network. Have a good night.
Have a good night.
If anybody wants to try their microphone just to see, you know, if it works, if they want to talk up, just hit the talk button on the left of your screen and say hello if you'd like to. Okay, thank you very much. Tomorrow, I believe we have 3 classes. Actually, if people are interested, everything's on the website, www.torahinmotion.org. Bye-bye.